Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Thriving Minds podcast. I'm Professor Selena Bartlett, and today we're joined by Dr. James Mukey, who's the Lieutenant Governor of South Australia, and he's given us his time this morning to help share his amazing work in starting a nonprofit and also being an eye surgeon. And thank you, James, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Selena, and lovely to see you again after a couple of years. A lot has happened in the last 2 years since we've seen each other.
I'll say, especially you winning Australian of the Year the following year after we met in 2019. So congratulations on that for your 32 years of humanitarian work, which is really impressive. Would you like to tell the audience a little bit about that experience?
Thank you. I think when I met Shu, I was nominated or elected as South Australian of the Year, and it was about November 2019, and we met just after that. And I was not expecting to win Australian of the Year, particularly because the year before, Dr. Richard Harris, who was one of my classmates at university, he was granted Australian of the Year for his heroic effort in the cave rescue in Thailand. So there was no way that we're going to give it to another doctor from Adelaide. So it was quite a surprise when I did receive the award, but a wonderful honour, of course, and been busy using that platform to try and improve the health of Australians. Yeah.
So we met because I was giving a lecture on, and I didn't know you're in the audience, on sugar addiction and things like that. And before we segue into that topic, I thought it would be really nice if you tell the audience a little bit about what sparked your interest in Sight for All, the nonprofit organization. Do you want to share a little bit about the beginning of that journey? I think it started when you saw some children in Myanmar that were blind when they shouldn't be blind, for example.
Well, it actually started quite a long way before that. And I could also take you all the way back to my childhood. Yes. When I really, from those early years, I knew that I wanted to be a doctor, but I particularly wanted to be a surgeon. And I loved at the time working with my hands and doing very fine work, making model aeroplanes and things like that. So I knew I wanted to be an eye surgeon. I knew I wanted to be a microsurgeon, actually. And neurosurgery was one of the things that was really appealing to me in those early years. So I worked my arse off, excuse my language, to get into medicine, and then to get into specialty training. You know, to work really hard through medical school, and ultimately, once I finished my internship in 1989, I think it was, I went off to Africa to work as a volunteer doctor in Kenya, in a little hospital in the mountains of central Kenya.
Can I ask you what inspired you to do that? Because that's quite an unusual step, I would suggest.
What was interesting is that through medical school, and then worked so hard through high school and medical school, and then during my internship, I was becoming a little disillusioned. And it was mainly because I was encountering patients who had diseases that were chronic and primarily self-inflicted, particularly smoking-related diseases back then. And we're also starting to see a poor diet creep in to drive chronic disease. So it was frustrating for me. I'm a sort of a project-driven and results-driven person. That's my personality. So I like to have results, and with patients with chronic diseases who are on this downhill slide, it just didn't sit well with me. I just needed a change. And during fifth year, at the end of fifth year, actually, I had an opportunity to do an elective, and I went to Kenya. That really inspired me to go back to Kenya after I had graduated. In fact, I came across this little hospital in the mountains named Tumu Tumu Hospital in the foothill of the Aberdeen Mountains, a very beautiful area. And I fell in love with this place. I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to one day come back here? So during my internship, when I was feeling a little bit disillusioned, I wrote to the hospital and they accepted me to come back and work there. And that was such a fabulous, fabulous experience. It did reinvigorate my love of medicine, and it also forged a desire to pursue a career in public health, because what I was doing now was seeing patients who had diseases that were not self-inflicted. The chronic disease epidemic hadn't hit at that point in time, mainly diseases that were infectious. I was actually, so malaria and TB, things like that. I was had the opportunity to be involved in surgery and delivering babies, which was such a fabulous experience. It was a very positive experience, but I still had this desire to use my hands to do microsurgery. And fortunately, while I was in Kenya, I received a phone call from the director of the eye department here in Adelaide at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, offering me the training position in ophthalmology. So I came back in 1990 to start my training in ophthalmology, and still through that time I was still unsure as to whether I would stick with medicine. I was actually amazingly exploring the opportunity to drop out of medicine and go to Italy and learn furniture design. I was actually building furniture, designing furniture, and that was something that was also a passion. But I loved ophthalmology, loved the surgery. And so the desire to use microsurgery to fight blindness, and particularly to fight blindness in poorer communities, was something that really spurred my enthusiasm to get involved in public eye health in poorer countries.
And then how did you, there's a term there that I would really like to go deeper into, but I want to finish off on how you started Sight for All. And can we come back to that self-inflicted? Because I think that's a really, really important conversation that we need to talk about later around sugar and diet and that kind of thing. And what you were seeing, how frustrating that is. And it is very frustrating for both of us. But in terms of Sight for All, that organization then sprung from obviously your ophthalmology, eye surgery, and your wanting to help others get the same capacities as you in other countries that didn't have access to the same education. Would you say that's part of it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So when I came back to Adelaide, I actually, following my eye training, I went and lived in Jerusalem and worked at St. John's Eye Hospital, and that really cemented this passion to continue working in this area. I travelled on to the UK and studied eye cancer in London, and then ultimately came back to Adelaide to settle in 1998. So to keep that love of fighting blindness in poorer communities alive, I got involved in a number of research and teaching projects with colleagues from the Royal Adelaide Hospital. And I remember one of the earliest trips was in year 2000, actually, and being an eye cancer specialist, I was amazed. This was my first real teaching opportunity in Asia. And my colleagues at the Yangon Eye Hospital in Myanmar, so that was my first trip, were well-trained and great surgeons, but primarily the training had been around cataract surgery and cataract blindness. Cataract is the leading cause of blindness in the world, but it actually only makes up half of all the blinding diseases. And so virtually all of the other diseases had been neglected and poorly taught. And so there was a huge need I saw. And particularly with my own specialty, I was amazed at the patients who had a variety of eye cancers that had been misdiagnosed. They didn't even weren't even aware that they were eye cancers in some respects. So I realized that there was a real need here to train our colleagues. We have about 10 subspecialty areas in ophthalmology. And so I then started to organize training programs for each of those subspecialties. And that formed the basis of a program called the Vision Myanmar program, which was ultimately funded by AusAid some years ago. And it really evolved from there. So I co-founded Sight for All. There was a number of colleagues at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, and we had projects and interests in a variety of countries. Myanmar was one, Sri Lanka was another. And so we decided to really pull our expertise and to set up an organization, Sight for All, which could then kind of act as an overseeing body for the projects that we were involved in, to help also grow projects and to fundraise for those projects as well. So that's really how Sight for All evolved, and it really, really came to fruition in 2007. We were registered as a not-for-profit in 2008 and have grown since then. So we are an organization dedicated to fighting blindness, and we have four key pillars. So research. So research often underlies much of the work that we do. The second pillar is education, and particularly sustainable education of our colleagues, so that they can comprehensively fight all of the blinding diseases that they come across. So we're not a fly-in, fly-out service. We are a teach the man to fish service, mm-hmm. and leave that skill and expertise behind. And then ensuring that, along with that education, they have the appropriate equipment to be able to deal with all of the blinding diseases they come across. And once we've done that, we like to ensure that there is an element of raising awareness in the communities so that they can maximise the opportunity to treat patients who are so very much in need in those countries. And yet there are a number of really powerful experiences that I've had which help drive that passion to want it to improve the lot of our colleagues in those countries.
Would you like to share with the audience a story that really touched you in one of these situations you found yourself in the early days that really drove your passion to probably be catalyzed and amplified?
Yeah, there was one. I have a number of experiences, and it's those experiences that really drive, I think, the humanitarian spirit. When you look at a humanitarian spirit, people often ask me, you know, what was the driving force behind my work, and it often does relate to these really powerful experiences you have as throughout your life, and for me throughout my medical career. And I can tell you a number of experiences, but I think the one that really encapsulates what we do is I mentioned our four key pillars of the work that we do, and particularly research driving that. So I was involved in a childhood blindness study in Myanmar back in 2007. And what we found there was really quite staggering. We visited seven schools for the blind across the country. And we found that nearly half of the children had blindness that could have been prevented or treated. So half were needlessly blind and shouldn't even be at those schools. But what was also deeply concerning was that only a fraction of the children who were blind even made it to schools for the blind, let alone any form of education at all. So most of the kids were hidden away in villages, perhaps a source of shame to their family and certainly a burden on their community. But I think really the most powerful thing of that research experience, that childhood blindness study in Myanmar, was that it was the leading cause of blindness that we found, and it was measles. And most people, even my medical colleagues, aren't aware that measles is a blinding disease. I probably read it somewhere during my training, but then to be surrounded by children at schools for the blind across this country was one of the most deeply moving, one of the most confronting and powerful experiences of my clinical life. And I came back to Australia, I wrote up the paper from this study, and all the time I was thinking, we have to be able to do something about this. At the time, there was no children's eye specialist. So pediatric ophthalmology is one of the subspecialty areas of ophthalmology. And yet there was no pediatric ophthalmologist to not only treat, but to also advocate for children with blinding yet preventable diseases such as measles. So I went back the following year to Myanmar to meet with the health minister. And I laid that research paper after it had been published, I laid it on his lap. And he had a quick read of the abstract, and then he looked up at me and said, oh, I thought we were doing better. So that was actually a really powerful moment, because I then had the blessing of the health minister, the approval of the health minister to train a children's eye specialist for this country. So the following year, in fact, it was a couple of years later, it was in 2010, we brought a young eye specialist from Yangon Eye Hospital, I mentioned before, to Australia to train. He came and spent a year with myself and my colleagues at the Women's and Children's Hospital training to be a pediatric ophthalmologist. So he went home at the end of the hands-on year of training here in Adelaide, and we set him up in the country's very first children's eye unit at Yangon Eye Hospital. So we ensured he had the equipment, the surgical instruments, the diagnostic tools to be able to treat children as we were here in Australia. And wind the clock forward over 10 years now, and he is now providing close to 30,000 treatments to kids every year, which is absolutely staggering in itself. But I think what's even more powerful is that he started to use his expertise to train his colleagues once his confidence and competence had got to a level where he was comfortable to do that. So in 2015, he finished training the second pediatric ophthalmologist for the country, and he now trains at least two every single year. So it really shows you the sustainability of the work that we do, which is really a hallmark of Sightfull's work. So that shows you the research driving the education and making sure that education is supported with the appropriate equipment. And now we're also involved in raising awareness about some of these really critical blinding diseases in children in countries such as Myanmar. But Myanmar was one of a number of countries that I was involved in childhood blindness studies in Cambodia and in Laos. We also found that measles was a leading cause of blindness. So it really was a powerful driver then to set up pediatric eye units, train children's eye specialists in a number of countries through Asia. And pediatric ophthalmology is, as I mentioned, only one of 10 subspecialty areas. So we've also been training in each of those subspecialty areas. And our projects are collectively impacting on the lives of, well, I suspect, a million people every year now.
Yeah, that's quite a powerful story, isn't it? The power of one, because often we don't think that we can make a difference. Most people think and don't know where to start, to be honest. When they see a problem, it seems systemic and very difficult to solve. And so I think that what that says to me in reflection is that if you can make a change like that in a country with very few resources, then it gets us back to that circle question of back to your internship. Why can't we make systemic changes around what food and diet people getting exposed to? Because I think that word self-inflicted is such a powerful word, because if you actually go and research it really, really deeply and get really down into the details, it's actually not self-inflicted. It's actually inflicted at a very high level that people are not even aware of, because of and we could have a huge conversation around this. Let's just preface it with, you won Australian of the Year in 2020, and you went to use that platform to raise awareness, not about your initiative in countries of needlessly blind, but around in our own country and other countries around diet and sugary, high processed foods. So can we just have a little conversation around what made you do that, considering what you just led into this conversation with about what you were doing?
Yes, I could have had a joyous year talking about Sight for All and all the wonderful work that we're doing. And I think I would have had a much more relaxing year if I had done that. But I actually took a different path. I mean, I spent much of the year talking about Sight for All, and Sight for All was really very prominent in all of these discussions. And it really harks back to late 2018 when I was doing a little documentary with my son, actually, who's a filmmaker, looking at the experience of blindness, what it actually means to be blind. And I interviewed a number of patients who are blind. Four children who have been born blind, four elderly people who are slowly going blind toward the end of their life, and two people in the middle of their life, in the prime of their life, who'd suddenly gone blind due to their diabetes. And one of those, a man named Neil Hansel, his story was so hugely, hugely powerful. He went to bed one night with normal sight and woke up the next morning blind in both eyes, and remains blind to this day. And it was such a harrowing, devastating story that it really made me sit up and think about this. And I thought back, I mentioned that I've been in the world of ophthalmology now for 32 years. So I've been dealing with the consequences of eye disease due to diabetes for this time. And what I've noticed over this period of time is the rise in eye disease, and particularly sight-threatening eye disease due to, in particular, the rise of type 2 diabetes. So type 2 diabetes makes up about 90% of cases and is a largely avoidable man-made dietary disease. So I actually now have over 100 patients, probably well over 100 patients, who have active sight-threatening eye disease due to their type 2 diabetes, who I'm actively treating with injections into their eyes or laser treatment or sometimes surgical, very fine surgery on the retina that I have to refer to my colleagues. So me myself have a huge number of patients who are literally on the edge of blindness. Diabetes is now the leading cause of blindness amongst working age adults in this country. And people really need to sit up and take notice of this. Why is it such a blinding problem? Well, we now have close to 1.8 million people with diabetes in Australia. And well over half are not having their regular, all-important sight-saving eye checks. And so that's why it's become such a blinding problem in our society. So all of these patients that I'm seeing, and unfortunately the vast majority, we're stopping going blind. In fact, 98% of the blindness and loss of vision due to diabetes is preventable or treatable. Unfortunately, Neil wasn't one of those. And Neil's story, as mentioned, was so very harrowing that it really made me sit up and realize that, okay, I'm the doctor at the end of the line treating these end-stage complications. The driver, as I mentioned, of type 2 diabetes is primarily dietary. And I never once thought it was my responsibility, my role, to have those dietary conversations with my patients. I always just presumed that those conversations were happening with the nutritionist, with the dietitian, with the GPs. But when I became Australian of the Year, I thought, okay, but this is such a critical health crisis in our country. It is the biggest health crisis that we have. If you look back at 2020, my year as Australian of the Year, we lost 15 times more lives to type 2 diabetes than to the COVID pandemic. So this is the hidden pandemic that's been largely ignored. And so that was a real eye-opener to me. I think many of us, if not all of us, are aware that type 2 diabetes is largely preventable. But what I wasn't aware of is that it was also potentially reversible. There are a number of clinical modalities that can actually put type 2 diabetes into remission. And so that was an extraordinary thing for me to learn, that actually, firstly, Neil didn't need to go blind, but equally, he didn't even need to develop type 2 diabetes. And so moving forward, when I received that award, I thought, well, this is the opportunity for me to raise awareness about this critical issue that type 2 diabetes is not just preventable, it's potentially reversible. And so I spent my year, rather stressful year, because there are so many powers trying to silence those really important messages.
And as you know, this is work I've been doing for a long time too, showing that sugar is addictive. But we're going to be, you know, one of the original people in America at University of California, San Francisco, Dr. Robert Lustig, who I'm sure you know, he's going to come on the podcast as well. I worked closely with him in the late 2000s, and our lab showed sugars addictive as alcohol and nicotine to the brain, which is what we discussed after that, during that conversation. And as I started to, and that was an unexpected finding from our lab, because we were working on alcohol at the time. It was just a control in our research studies, speaking of how research translates into public good. And what I was alarmed to discover, like you probably, as we drill really, really deep down into why this happened and how, because it wasn't always the case, was it? We didn't always have this problem about how sugars become embedded across the food chain. So I think that's a really important conversation to have, because without awareness, you can't change something. And this awareness piece, this education piece, as you said, part of the pillars of what you've been doing to educate people in, you know, ophthalmology surgery in other countries. Why is this one, in a country that has access to so much information so quickly, why is this topic so hard for people to get access to, I guess, in some places, without it being, you know, a problematic conversation, I guess?
Yes, oh, it's fascinating. I remember vividly sitting in the lecture hall and listening to your wonderful presentation. And so here I am, a medical doctor of close to 40 years. And I was sitting in the lecture hall listening to you talk about the addictive nature of sugar. And that was the first time that I'd clicked to just how addictive sugar is. So that was a really powerful and very pivotal moment in my career. And I very much credit you for changing my whole thinking on this. And it actually formed a really powerful pillar to my advocacy over the last couple of years since receiving the award. But as I mentioned, leading up to the award, I was not expecting to win it, but I read quite a lot. I was thinking about it quite a lot from the moment I listened to your speech through to the award ceremony. And I came up with this concept called the five A's of sugar toxicity. I don't know if you've heard me talking about that. So the very first one was, and often the hidden elephant in the room is the addictive nature of sugar. So addiction is my first A of sugar toxicity. It's as addictive as nicotine. And we often use sugar to alleviate stress or to make us feel better when we're down. So alleviation was the second A. The third A was accessibility. So sugar is cheap and sugar is absolutely everywhere in our environment these days, isn't it? You can't walk into the service station without being confronted by a wall of confectionery. You can't check out from most supermarkets and stores, even post offices and chemists these days, without being enticed by half-priced sugary drinks and chocolates and so forth. The fourth A is addition. So an astronomical amount of sugar is added to our food and drink, something like in the order of 75%, particularly those ultra-processed foods, or what I prefer to call ultra-processed food-like substances, which are really dangerous to our health. And the final A is advertising. So our world is absolutely flooded with TV commercials and ads for sugary products, you know, often in the most insidious of ways. So these five A's of sugar toxicity were, for me, a really great way of thinking about the danger of sugar. And we know and from Dr. Lustig's work and many others, that there are over 8,000 studies linking sugar to a range of chronic diseases. So there's no question here that it is a dangerous substance. So it also, the five A's also allowed me to think about, you know, strategy out of it. But as the year progressed, I realized, in fact, that it's not just sugar and also the refined carbohydrates, which I call sugar in disguise. So products such as white flour, white rice, white potatoes, and the foods prepared from these. So these are virtually pure starch, and starch is broken down. It's actually a long chain of glucose, which is broken down into single glucose molecules as soon as it reaches the gut. So when we're consuming refined carbohydrates, we're pretty much consuming sugar as well. And the final piece of the puzzle for me are the seed oils, polyunsaturated omega-6 fatty acid oils, what we euphemistically call the vegetable oils, which are actually dangerous to our health. But for the last 40, 50 years, they've been promoted as a healthy alternative to natural saturated fats. And they're actually driving also chronic disease. But when you combine all of these three substances, sugar, refined carbohydrates, the seed oils, into ultra-processed food-like substances, you have this product which is being consumed in enormous amounts. In America, it makes up 62% of the calories of the American diet, two-thirds of the calories of American children. In the UK, it's over 50%, and I suspect we're close to 50% of our diet here. And they're like a loaded gun which are pointed directly at our livers and really driving metabolic dysfunction and poor health.
Yeah, so that's why this is why it's such a loaded term, the word self-inflicted, because you'll see graphs around research saying, well, actually sugar, like they're tracking the increase in sugar consumption with obesity, for example, and then saying, but look, it hasn't increased recently, but it's been replaced with many, many other things too, which you're talking about. And I don't know if you know Moskowitz's work from decades ago, demonstrating and working out what the bliss point is. So trying to work out what the right combination of sugar, salt, and fat is to create bliss in terms of how you feel when you're tasting it. And you know when you're tasting something that's blissful, if you know what I mean.
Exactly.
So if you're not aware about the, like, you saw what it took for you and I to become aware of this, and I was struggling honestly, and I was using sugar to medicate my stress when I was running a lab, big lab in America, etc., raising a family. I was unaware, and I was I guess, not in the field of nutrition or anything like that at the time. And you're a doctor working in chronic diseases and being trained for a really long period of time. And we even have people in nutrition and other places trained. But the thing that I've noticed, and if you don't mind me talking about sugar for a second, is that we just count it as calories. And what isn't talked about is that sugar replaced fat in the 60s, late 60s, because we were taught fat was bad. So I don't know if you want to talk to a little bit about that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I was going to let you go for a bit, but
Well, you're a doctor. So.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because there are two things that we all kind of know, one of which is that breakfast is the most important meal of the day. This phrase was actually popularized by John Harvey Kellogg in 1906 to market his newly invented breakfast cereal, Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And yet, to this day, there's not a shred of evidence to say that we actually need to have breakfast, and particularly cereal for breakfast. In fact, I think many of us will do much better without having cereal for breakfast. So that's something that we know. I think it's probably the most powerful marketing slogan that's ever arisen. And I think it's one component of because basically these breakfast cereals are just packed with sugar. Even the healthy ones are very sugary, and they're ultra processed, and ultimately they're not great for us. There's no need to have cereal for breakfast. But of course, the cereal industry don't like you telling people that. The other thing that we kind of inherently know is that saturated fat is bad for us. And this was something that was rammed down our throats, 50 years or so ago. And that was driven by the understanding or the discovery that in those years and the decades after World War II that we really started to see a rise in heart attacks. And it was thought that this was due to our fatty diet causing fatty blockage of the coronary arteries. And so on no strong scientific evidence, in fact, the evidence was flawed and corrupted, the recommendation became to reduce the saturated fat in our diet. And when you take saturated fat out of a diet, you take away its flavor and you take away its ability to make you feel satisfied or satiated. So something had to replace that, and what replaced that were carbohydrates. And so the recommendations in 1980, the American Dietary Guidelines, was essentially a high carb, low fat eating recommendation, eating pattern. And that seeded dietary guidelines across the world, including our own Australian dietary guidelines, which to this day continue to encourage the eating of cereals and grains, so a high carbohydrate. They encourage the eating of polyunsaturated seed oils, which I mentioned are unhealthy, and they discourage the eating of saturated fats, but particularly natural saturated fats. And yet, there's no strong evidence to say the natural saturated fat in our diet are linked to cardiovascular disease. There are now 4 Cochrane reviews, the highest level of evidence, exonerating natural saturated fats as a driver of cardiovascular disease. And yet it is still being pushed by national health, dietary health policies.
Yeah, I don't know. Using your platform, I was hoping, and being of high profile as you are, that I was hoping that you'd be able to open the doors on this, because it's like a religion, isn't it? in some sense, that we're either for or against something. And I think the thing that struck me the most after, once limiting my own sugar intake and noticing that all of a sudden I could run and start to lose weight around my waistline for the first time in 10 years. And then second, so that was shocking to me. And then that's how I kind of started to stumble more and more into this field in some sense. It's like sugar isn't its calorie count, and we're always so focused on you should have this many calories a day. And when I say that, what we're talking to the audience about, and what you probably realize too, is that it's the way the body stores it is not how it's meant to be stored. That kind of energy from fructose isn't meant to be stored in those places. It's storing it because we can't get rid of it. We don't have enough. We have to run, a marathon just to get rid of, say, a few chocolate bars, for example, and people won't be aware of that. And that's why I like that term, what do we mean by self-inflicted? where do we start? You know, how do we change the conversation at the across the whole gamut here, from us as individuals where we can make a difference for our own health, but then all through these different places, you know, because if the dietary guidelines and you've got diabetes is giving you that as your what you should eat, then aren't you following what you're meant to do, kind of thing, as a human being?
Absolutely. And when I say self-inflicted, that's not willfully self-inflicted.
No.
People aren't aware. I think certainly when I was in my internship and all the smoking-related diseases, there's a hugely addictive component to cigarette smoking, of course. And this was, you know, driving this huge epidemic, particularly of cardiovascular disease. But if you look back at in the years after World War II, something like 80% of men smoked. We're now down, I think, about 14%. So there are a number of strategies that were, you know, once we discovered how dangerous cigarette smoking was for us in the 60s, there are a number of strategies that were put in place, and that's resulted in this decline in smoking, as opposed to, you know, sugar consumption, type 2 diabetes, and its complications, which are really on the rise. And it's such an insidious thing, and particularly when our dietary guidelines are saying to have this high carb dietary pattern, then people feel like they're doing as they're told. They're doing the right thing. They're eating by the dietary guidelines. Even the diabetes associations, even our many of our medical associations, encourage us to eat by the dietary guidelines. And the dietary guidelines are actually very powerful, because they inform what's eaten in schools all the way through to aged care. They inform what's eaten in prisons, hospitals, the defence force. It informs healthcare workers and educators, health policy makers. So they're really very powerful. They also inform the food industry. So there have been quite literally thousands of low-fat products that have been created on the back of all of this, and yet it is driving this poor health. And so it is deeply concerning. We need to change those dietary guidelines. There has been significant industry influence in the creation of those guidelines, and going forward, the Dietary Guideline Committee for the next draft of the Australian Dietary Guidelines commenced last year, but it's a 3-4 year process, and what we hope is that it will literally change the recommendation away from this high carbohydrate, high seed oil eating recommendation to a much healthier recommendation. That's what we're hoping. But in the meantime, you know, if it's 3 years away, we're going to see probably 100,000 new cases of type 2 diabetes being diagnosed every year, probably in the order of 15,000 deaths every year. So what's needed, what's absolutely needed, and over the last 2 years, I've been encouraging the government, encouraging our Department of Health to start to raise awareness. I mean, there's been very, very little, if anything, that I've seen. Certainly on free-to-air TV, there's quite a bit of social media work on this from various organisations, and it's great to see the Australian Medical Association just in the last month or two start their Sickly Sweet campaign, discouraging the consuming of sugary drinks. But I think one of the things that's really important as well is that you mentioned before about the number of calories. It's really not the number of calories, but it's the type of calories that we're consuming, which is so dangerous, and particularly the fructose element that you mentioned and the seed oils, which are driving metabolic dysfunction, mm-hmm. fatty liver, insulin resistance. And often obesity comes into the discussion. Yes, obesity is a marker for poor metabolic health. It's actually the biggest risk factor for type 2 diabetes. But what's really important, and Robert Lustig was very, very powerful in bringing this to my awareness, is that in the United States, and I suspect here in Australia, there are now more thin metabolically unhealthy people than there are overweight or obese metabolically unhealthy people. So obesity is not the conversation here. It is actually the type of calories we're consuming. And 2 years ago, almost to the day, I had a scan of my abdomen for a back problem, and I found out that I had a fatty liver. And for those of you who have seen me, I'm tall and thin. So I'm what they call toffee, so thin on the outside, fat on the inside. And I realized when I looked at my diet quite how bad it was, and it was driving in me unknowingly, unwittingly, this poor metabolic health. And potentially I was on the pathway to pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes if I continued on that same pathway.
This is the story that, you know, we're everyone listening, we're not alone, it's all of us. And and for me it was really shocking too, because I found it quite shocking, and that's why we want to do this podcast together, is help other people raise awareness and know that they can do something about it. It can be as simple as, like, right now today, just have one less sugary or carbohydrate laden item, just take one out. It'll make a big difference, because getting started is really hard when you're in a habit of medicating your stress. Like, that's what I was doing too. I don't know if that's what you were doing. You had your favorite thing that you like to eat or drink when you're feeling, because you're doing so many things, juggling so many, looking after people's health. You know, it's a really stressful job doing surgery, isn't it?
Yeah, I was probably unwittingly using sugary products to alleviate this. But I know, there's no doubt that I was highly addicted to sugar.
What was your go-to, out of interest?
My absolute weakness is ice cream.
Oh, and, yes.
You know, ice cream is sugary, but it's also creamier. Sugar and fat. Yeah. And it's that combination of the two, the bliss point that you mentioned before. And I understand that there are no foods in our natural environment that have that combination of sugar and fat. So it's a baddie, particularly.
How did you start, though, when you got this? Was it the wake-up call that allowed you to, because this is what we're here to do, is help people work out this. You know, I started by taking one item out, and I was also planning running at the same time, and I started standing instead of sitting as much at work. That's kind of how I got started. What did you do, James? What can you do to help others listening that are maybe struggling a little bit as well?
Absolutely, I'll definitely come to that. On your point, so about exercise and diet, diet is by far the biggest driver of this. In fact, our poor diet is responsible for more disease and death in the world than smoking, alcohol, and inactivity combined. That Simon Capel's work out of the UK.
So, can you say that again? Say that again.
So our poor diet, which is laced with sugary drinks and ultra-processed foods, is responsible for more disease and death than smoking, alcohol, and inactivity combined. So diet is the huge driver of this. So coming to your point, you know, basically I went cold turkey, my detox from sugar. And I've done it a couple of times before. When I was, again, going back to those days in January of 2020, I thought, if I'm going to be talking about this, I better walk the talk. So I went into a sugar detox, but I'd done it a couple of times before. One, when I was trying to lose some weight to do a trek in Bhutan in the Himalayas. Another time I'm not a great sleeper, and I was thinking perhaps my diet was driving poor sleep. So I went into a detox a few years back, and both of those times I actually became quite unwell. And it wasn't until more recently that I realized why it made me so unwell. But certainly, again, in January 2020, I had the same experience. I went into the sugar detox. I went cold turkey, and bang, it hits you. It's amazing. There are people, even with my post, will come out and say, oh, no, sugar's not addictive. It really is. And until you actually detox from sugar, you won't realize quite how addictive it is. And the withdrawal symptoms literally begin on day one. So for me, what did I do? I gave up the obviously sugary things. So I gave up the ice cream. Sadly, there was rarely a day in my life where I hadn't had ice cream after dinner since my childhood. So that was my absolute favorite. But I also gave up sugary drinks, and that not just soft drinks and flavored milks, but also juices. So a glass of orange juice has almost as much sugar as a glass of cola, for example. So I gave up confectionery. I gave up biscuits and cake. At work each day, I would probably make my way through a packet of cream biscuits through the day. So those were some of the sugary things that I gave up. And literally day one, bang, the symptoms hit me very, very quickly. So headache, this incredible sort of fatigue where you feel like you're really walking through concrete. Irritability is also very powerful, and the cravings are just extraordinary. And the symptoms were there for me for about 3 days, and the cravings built and built and built. It's really quite tough actually to try and get through that period. Some people it might be a bit longer. And then after day three for me, the symptoms started to ease off. But you can actually go even harder than that. So it's a good way to start. It is, and what I found with myself was just to take a couple of Panadols judiciously to try and ease those sort of cravings and ease those symptoms. And it really did work. And then once you've actually detoxed, it's actually incredibly liberating. You can walk past the freezer and generally when there's ice cream in the fridge at home, and these days we rarely, rarely have it, it would be calling out to me. But when you've detoxed, you can actually walk past the freezer or walk past the pantry and not be drawn to those sugary products. Or you can go to the service station and be filling up your petrol and not be enticed by those 2-for-1 chocolate deals that are advertised on the nozzle, or not be victim to the predatory marketing tactics of industry when you're at the checkout counter of the supermarket, you know, not to succumb to those enticements. And this is why it's so hard for people when they're not aware of how addictive sugar it is, but they're trying to do the right thing. They're trying to cut back on their sugar and carbs. And when everywhere in your environment, you're being bombarded by enticements from the fast food industry, from the sugary drinks industry, from the ultra processed food industry, it is so hard for people to detox and to, even if they are willing to try and put their type 2 diabetes into remission, to actually have success, because at every turn you are just being bombarded by alluring addictive products.
I know it's really, really hard. Because before I was aware, before I got these epiphanies, and I just got fortunate to stumble across sugar impact on the brain in our research lab, unwittingly knowing I was doing the same thing myself, I actually was of the mindset, to be honest, that if this is available, it must be healthy. In a way, it must be okay when a new thing comes out and they market it as healthy. Like I can think about, without naming brands or anything, you talk about juices and, you know, how they have all these new ways of making them fancy and look really healthy. And you think you're doing the right thing by your children, rewarding them after, say, they've played soccer or something or done something, you would reward them with one of these outings. If you know what I mean, and then they come to love it, and it's such a cycle. And this is before I was aware. I had no idea that I was doing this to myself, but also to my children. I thought I was doing the right thing, and it's no one's fault. It's just the nature of, I guess, I don't even know where to start, because you think it's healthy. Basically.
Oh, absolutely. And we're told it's healthy as well, aren't we? And I know I shudder to think what we fed our kids and what they drank over those early years. But fortunately, children, you know, often have a high metabolism. But we know type 2 diabetes is impacting on kids now.
Yes.
When I was in medical school, it was called maturity onset diabetes. We're now seeing it in children as young as 3. And Northern Australia leads the world for type 2 diabetes in young children. That is not something to be proud of. And yet, once again, it is so potentially reversible to turn this epidemic around. But then another, we talked about the Australian Dietary Guidelines. We talk about the Health Star rating system. And when we have these ultra-processed food-like substances with 5 stars on them telling us that it's healthy, then people implicitly trust that those rating systems are an indicator of a healthy product. But when you realize that there's a couple of things here, that the Health Star rating system, it's a voluntary system. So only about 30% of manufacturers use it. So there is a flaw in itself. But when you realize that this was an industry device devised by the food industry for the industry, they don't have our health in mind. It's all about profits and to drive this false sense that what people are consuming is a healthy product. And the other thing that's really very, very critical here is we need a clear and transparent labeling system telling people exactly how much sugar is contained within. My last post a few days ago was a Slurpee, a sour orange Slurpee by 7-Eleven. Would you realize that that has 50 teaspoons of sugar in the mega size? I mean, that is unbelievable to think that a kid would buy a mega size Slurpee for $3.
Yeah.
And hit themselves with 50 teaspoons. Unbelievable. So we need a clear and transparent labeling system telling us exactly how much sugar is contained within. But then you look at also that there are something like 260 plus different names for sugar, and there are 56 common ones which are used commonly by the food industry, and that only serves to confuse the consumer even more. So there is real accountability here, and I came up with another sort of overarching strategy, really. We talked about the 5 A's of sugar toxicity, but I came up with this overarching strategy that we need and which I communicated to our government. So there's action is what we need, awareness, accountability, and assistance. And we've covered a lot of these things already. So awareness of type 2 diabetes, its preventability and potential reversibility, awareness of the complications of type 2 diabetes. Neil Hansel, I mentioned before, who went blind when he was diagnosed, wasn't aware what lay await for him. Not just blind in both eyes, he's had 2 heart attacks, he's had 9 amputations. You know, this poor guy, and he wasn't aware of how devastating this disease is. So awareness is critical, you know, awareness of these 5 A's of sugar toxicity, awareness of our flawed dietary guidelines, awareness of our flawed health star rating system, awareness run through this so critically. And so we need action by government to raise awareness. We need to see ads, TV commercials telling people, like we've done for cigarette smoking,
that these
substances are dangerous. And then accountability, the second A, we need accountability of businesses and industry to stop this predatory marketing that's going on. And we need accountability of the government to hold to account these businesses who are preying on our addictions, making it so difficult for people to give up. And finally, assistance. And there's lots of layers of assistance here that's needed. And one that just springs to mind for me, my son was in second year medicine a couple of years ago. He had the opportunity to do nutrition science as an elective. So as I mentioned, nutrition, poor diet is the biggest driver of our poor health. It's the biggest driver of this chronic disease epidemic. And yet it's not being taught. It's not compulsory in many of our major medical schools in this country. So there's so much that needed, and there's so much that our government can do to turn this around.
So do you think your son can pick up this mantle and around and try and make a difference? Following you too, are you creating a little sub Jameses?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, he's just told me this last week or two that he's interested in doing ophthalmology, and certainly in the house, and this is where it's really important, if someone's trying if they have type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes or insulin resistance or like me, a fatty liver, and they're trying to do the right thing, and yet the family is combating that. Really, the family needs to come along for the journey. And so that was a great thing in our household. I started talking about it a lot, and the family realized actually what we were consuming, what we had in the pantry. Those vegetable oils were bad for us, so we got rid of those. We stopped having ice cream in the fridge as a routine. We stopped having orange juice and fruit juices in the fridge. So the family came along for the ride, and our sons were also very much on board with it. When you actually look at the science, and I'm not talking about the science that's biased by the food industry or biased by religious ideology or biased by institutional conflicts of interest. If we look at the true science, the really solid evidence-based science, then it speaks for itself. These substances are bad for us. They are addictive. They are alluring, and we need to have that awareness to be able to help ourselves.
Oh, thank you. That was a great conversation. So I think just a little quick summary, if you want to do something, is just turn around to whatever you buy and have a look what's on the back of it. And that's where I started to. And I had no idea that, for example, tomato sauce was full of sugar, which is, you know, people like tomato. Yeah, these are simple little things, but also low-fat yogurt's another one, especially the strawberry kind. That was like having a can of Coke. I had no idea. I used to give my kids that when they were little, thinking low-fat was really good for them. And the list goes on. So, and you can arm yourself and inform yourself. There's so many websites now as well. Another way is to visualize this in your head. Hold out a sandwich bag, like a clear plastic bag. Now imagine you have a bag full of just table sugar sitting next to you. And now take 32 teaspoons and put it into that clear plastic bag, 32 teaspoons. Now look at that bag. That's how much you can drink in one can of some types of soda.
And this is amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's even hard to even get your mind around that. And this is the these are some of the tools they're using actually in Auckland, at the some of the foundations over there trying to help in the Pacific Islander area, teaching how in those communities, because I was giving a talk over there, they have. This particular brand that's there, and one serving has 32 teaspoons of sugar in it. I'm not going to name the brand, but and there, some of them are having three in a day, and these are kids under 18 and families, and they just would have no awareness of just how much sugar that they're consuming. So these are just some of the little things we can do to help raise awareness, is to use visuals. Some people like to listen. Some people like to read. I think we just have to use a multi-prong approach to change this conversation. That was great, James. And thank you so much for taking that as your platform when you could have easily taken your nonprofit forward as a platform. And I think that's really great for our country. I just wish it didn't happen during the pandemic. Even though this is a pandemic of way greater proportions than, but, you know, I understand what we had to do in 2020, 2021. So as we head to the close, because I know you've got so much on your plate and we're so grateful for your time on this podcast, I think it's really helped a lot of people. I'd like you to reflect a little bit and tell the audience, well, you've achieved all these things now, and now you're also Lieutenant Governor of South Australia. On top of everything else you're doing, running your nonprofit and actually still seeing patients, where do you want to go to next? Is it possible, or are you in now a position where you're not allowed to use a platform to help educate Australians and improve our diet?
Well, yes, absolutely. So as Lieutenant Governor, that's a part-time role. And when I'm Lieutenant Governor, I have to be cautious about what I say. And but between times, I should be able to continue doing the work, the advocacy work that I'm doing. And I've actually recently created or launched what we call a network for systemic change. So when we look at systematic problems, whether it be environment, climate change, our poor diet, our chronic disease epidemic, is no one entity, no one person can turn it round. So we need to weave everyone together who's working this space as part of a network for systemic change to ultimately have the impact that we're doing. So recently received funding, I've launched a network for systemic change, and it would be great to have you a part of it, Selena, mm-hmm. going forward. There are a number of people that that we'll weave into this, or a number of organisations will weave into this, and ultimately I'm hoping that we'll have the change that we need. If we look at smoking, it took decades to turn that round. That was one product, but this is a much more, this is a much broader, deeper problem than is smoking. So this is not just sugarcane farmers, sugar processing industry, sugar industry, sugary drinks industry, cereal and grain industry, processed food industry. It is so big, and it is going to take a long, long time to turn around, but it is doable. And we need governments to jump on board and to be accountable.
And the other thing is for people to make life a little bit easier, even though it's hard when you're raising a family and you're trying to get a meal on, you do turn to these things, which is what I did, pasta and all of those kind of things to feed a bit family quickly after working, etc. But really, as my parents have done and do still, it's that really simple formula, unfortunately, of that Mediterranean-like diet, which is lean meat and vegetables and fruits. So, like, just look at where the food is and how close it is from where it came from, meaning did it just get picked from a garden? That's probably a pretty good choice. People always ask about fruits. Are fruits really bad? No, because they're full of vitamins and fiber. And to eat the equivalent of in a strawberry milkshake of that many strawberries, you'd have to eat a few punnets of them, for example. So, you know, it's these simple concepts to help people start the journey. It's not easy to do, I wouldn't say, but it's definitely possible. And diabetes and type 2 diabetes and all of these diseases you're treating on the back end are way worse to end up having.
So. Exactly. And to your point there, I really like the phrase, just eat real food. and Dr. Gary Fetke, who's an orthopedic colleague of mine and someone you should have on your podcast if you haven't already, he has this very simple statement, eat seasonal, local, whole food, which is relevant to your environment and cultural background, and avoiding added sugar and ultra-processed foods. And there's no doubt whether you're vegan, carnivore, or anything in between, if you keep that in mind, you'll be highly unlikely to go down the type 2 diabetes pathway.
I really look forward to us and this systemic initiative. There's no doubt in my mind that the people that need this the most are in the most food insecure, largest distance from, real food as well. And I look forward to us being able to help change that, because I think that in itself could end up leading to such a massive help for people, because it's really hard on a poor diet to do anything. It's what we do to medicate stress. It's a circle. So thank you so much. And I'm so proud that you won that award and all of them in your CV. You've won many, and I'll put that in my link to my podcast so people can read about you even further. I look forward to seeing what's the next steps for you. I don't know if you're going to become governor. Is that how it works?
No, I think it's time for me to sit back and relax a bit after.
Your family might agree with you. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And congratulations on all you've done, Selena. And you have been a huge part of my journey, and that understanding of what you communicated to me at that lecture, that presentation, has been really a very, very powerful addition to, and in fact, I think it was probably one of the very key things that allowed me to move down this pathway about trying to raise awareness about poor diet. So thank you for what you've done. Thank you for your inspiration to me.
Well, thank you. I look forward to seeing you again in Adelaide sometime, and or you here. I don't know how it goes. You probably can't go anywhere now either.
Well, hopefully it's opening up now, so I think I'll be coming to Queensland later this year, so we'll look forward to seeing you.
Congratulations, and it's so lovely to talk to you today, and to our audience. I hope you got something benefit to you, your family. Just know that these small changes can take place daily, and you'll have a big impact on not just yourself, your family, but three generations going forward, because we now know that these things are inherited as well and can be passed along. So it's worth taking the step, and you'll feel better too. So thank you. And thank you, James, for being with us on the Thriving Minds podcast today.
Thanks, Lena. Great to be here.